How would you like to build a billion-dollar wealth management company? In today's episode, John Knowlton will tell us how he did this with his family. And what's so special about John is that he's the co-founder of Abundant Thought Revolution, and he built a billion-dollar wealth management firm, which he sold in 2020, then started helping marketplace leaders integrate Christian faith, strategy, and purpose. And now he leads the family board and investment committees and serves as the chief of staff at his church. Now, John, tell us about how can entrepreneurs enroll their family into managing the family wealth so they can build a billion-dollar wealth management company.
Welcome to Awakened Titans Podcast with Lily Patrescu, mind-blowing conversations with influential business titans sharing how you can manifest abundance, love, joy, success through quantum awakening, quantum manifestation, quantum healing, quantum miracles, exponential business growth, and innovative products and services.
Yeah, Lily, thanks so much for the opportunity to share. My goal is that this would be the most impactful conversations that the listeners hear this week. So I built with partners, not all by myself, of course, but I built a firm that managed $1.25 billion of client assets. And I exited at the end of 2020, and that firm's gone on to, they're near $5 billion now. So that's really awesome to see them continue to grow like that. Since the exit, I've done a couple of things, as you mentioned. One is served as what's called a C12 chair, and that's where I facilitated peer advisory groups for Christian CEOs, helping them build great businesses with kind of a double bottom line. You know, how do we build a profitable organization and focus on eternal outcomes? And then my wife and I have entered this project to bring our kids, our adult children, into the process of managing family wealth. And so we're thinking of how do we build a family that retains its identity as a force for good for generations?
Thank you. So one thing that I find quite fascinating is about how some people who create billions in wealth, or even millions, let's say, and once they pass, actually, a lot of the wealth gets wasted because the children were not involved in anything. And they just kind of like start fighting and so on. So I'm really interested to know in how can someone build a billion-dollar wealth management company and enroll the family? Tell us about, first of all, your 10 commandments in terms of values that you think are important. And then right after that, tell us about the pillars that you find so important in making this happen.
Sure. Yeah. You call them commandments. Another way to talk about it would be mission, vision, and values. So what's the mission? What's your family's mission? Just like any business should have a clear mission. Here's what we're doing. This is what we're about. Here's our project. And then our vision is how will the world be different if we're successful at our mission? If we keep grinding at our mission, there should be some impact on the world. And that's our vision. And then the values is values are typically stated as a noun, let's just say honesty, but then I like to have a verbal sentence that follows the noun. In other words, honesty. And so, for example, the verbal statement might be, we tell the truth no matter what, or we tell the truth even if it hurts, or something like that. And so your values are really the way that we're going to interact with each other and interact with the world. And when your business or your family can be clear about your mission, vision, and values, then an effective set of mission, vision, values arbitrates for you. They help you say yes to things and no to things so that you can be clear what we should do and what we shouldn't do. There's a million things we could do, which are the things that align with our family's mission, vision, and values.
Thank you. Give us some examples of your vision, mission, and values that have helped your family stay together and manage the wealth together and stay enrolled in that. Because I think it's very easy for most families to find that wealth be a topic of separateness and anger and sadness and like so many different negative emotions that really don't help anybody.
Yeah. So the traditional sort of estate planning approach is mom and dad have money and they do with it whatever they want. And then they die. And then there's a reading of the will or the trust is exposed and all that kind of thing. So Julie and I have decided, hey, we don't want to wait until we're dead, but bring the kids in now. So let me just give you, I'll give you two of our values and then a case study. So one of our family's values is self-sufficiency. In other words, all of our children have been educated, they've been trained, they have the ability to provide value in the world, and we expect them, and they expect themselves to earn their own way. You know, one is finishing her master's degree of business administration. She's got a recruiting job, and ultimately will go on to other types of careers. Her fiance is a physician. My other son runs a contracting company. He's a builder, etc. And so, value one there, self-sufficiency. Another value, though, that we have is support, that we help each other when it's needed. So you can see that those two things can be in tension. So one of my kids got in trouble. I'm not going to say exactly how, but I said to myself, I'm not going to make this decision myself of should I be hands off and let the natural consequences play out, or should I get involved and try to help this kid out of the trouble? And so I assembled the family board and laid out the issue, and I let my adult kids weigh in, and they wrestled with the competing values, self-sufficiency and support. And it was really a powerful conversation, Lily, on what they think the right course of action should be. Now, because they're a part of the decision, there isn't any resentment about whatever course of action I took or my wife and I chose. They were involved. They had input. And so many of those negative emotions or characteristics that you just mentioned, resentment, fear, distrust, these kinds of things, they occur because there's not communication between the generations. Mom and dad do their own thing and then don't communicate their rationale and whatnot. And so the second generation, the children or grandchildren, are wondering why, or they get whipsawed because of these what appear to be conflicting decisions in one case versus the next case and whatnot. And so we brought our kids in. We've got a structure, mission, vision, values that help guide our decision making, and they're part of the solution, if you will.
Thank you. Can you tell us more about how would someone go about creating a great mission or a great vision so they can empower the entire family to build a billion-dollar wealth management company?
Yeah, sure. So there's a series of questions that I take my family through. I've done this with privately held companies, family-owned businesses. There's a series of questions that we can go through. And I'll tell you, one of the most important tools that I use is called brain writing. So we're familiar, most of us, with brainstorming. And that's where we present a topic and then people sort of toss out their answers, or they, in some cases, they shout their answers out, right? Brain writing is a little different, because we pose the question and then I set a timer for 90 seconds or 2 minutes or so and invite people to write down their response. And then we go around the room or around the table one at a time and ask people to read their responses. And there's a little technique to this where the most dominant personality, I ensure, goes last, because I don't want the person who's loudest or most extroverted or has the most social power to influence the ideas of the other people in the group. And so the CEO goes last, the patriarch goes last, what have you. So I go last in these kinds of conversations. And so in that mechanism allows everyone's voice to be heard and not be influenced by the power, higher status people. And it's a really powerful. So you might just pose a question, hey, what makes our family special? Okay, so we're going to understand people's opinions on that. Okay, now we're working towards our mission. What do you think our family could do that no other families in our area could do? And let people brain write. And then, well, what could we do best? What are we really good at? And so now we're starting to discern. I'm not just asking what's our mission, but I'm asking qualities of a great family and what makes our family special and unique. And by this process, now we're discerning what's our family's mission. And you do the same thing with our vision. So if that's our mission, how might the world be different? How could we? And asking these type of open-ended questions, how might we? How could we? What if? You get really great, fruitful responses from people. And then you can walk through your values. How should we interact with each other? What's important to us? And then sometimes you'll get a lot of ideas. And then I give everybody a certain number of votes, and then we kind of vote on them. And it's just this process of winnowing down to what's actually core and true about our group.
Thank you. How does a family deal with sibling rivalry when it comes to managing their family wealth? Because I think that you could be a really great parent and you could, create a lot of wealth, But then the question comes, like, maybe you have four children, and maybe one child is very individualistic. Another child is very much about, helping the world. Another child is very much into football. I don't know. So, like, everyone could have their own interest and, gifts and so on. And at some point, I mean, I think most families have this kind of like sibling rivalry, unless all of these different values are cultivated and communicated. Like, for example, in my family, we had a lot of values that were unspoken. And I think that. And because of these values that were unspoken, but you can say practiced, like both my brother and I think we were brought up in a really great way. But I think some families may not have this kind of like upbringing. So, like, what can they do to deal with this kind of sibling rivalry when it comes to managing billion-dollar wealth management company?
Sure. Well, so if we're going to be part of the family, then we pursue our own interests. But when we're working in the context of the family, we're submitting our individual goals and desires to the common purpose, to the joint project. And so I may have said this and it just passed by, but we invited our kids to participate. And so my wife and I annually, we revisit this presentation, but we've sort of told the story of our family, our faith and finances, how they're connected throughout the course of our marriage, how we've tithed, how we've faced critical decisions and presented the questions before God and what we felt the response was, and then what was the outcome. And we've got this whole timeline, and we show pictures of the kids when they were young and then when they were teenagers, et cetera. And so we put the family board work in the context of this longstanding relationship that's developed over time. So the kids are all welcome to pursue their own interests, to pursue their own careers, to pursue whatever's important to them. But when they're working on family board stuff, we're orienting around the family's mission and the family's vision and the family's values. And so maybe we'll run into sibling rivalry at some point. At this point, we haven't, though. We've been able to be clear about that. And then just for in my family anyways, Lily, and I found this to be true with other families I've worked with, the sort of the way in, the easiest thing for young adults to grasp onto is giving money away. So, Gen Z and millennials they're very other focused in terms of, if you ask what do you want to do when you graduate college, the number one answer I hear is work for a nonprofit. And I'm like, that's not a job, that's a tax status. But the idea is they want to do something that they perceive as adding value, as a being a giver. And so the way in, the easiest way for them to participate in this work is to be on a philanthropy or a charity committee to think about how and to whom should we give money away. And so we actually, our oldest daughter is the chair of our philanthropy committee, and she set up the whole structure of how do we make requests and how do we make decisions about who gets money and all of that. And so in my experience, there isn't rivalry around that because we've got this clear framework.
Thank you. What would you say happens in families where there is sibling rivalry when it comes to dividing the wealth and when it comes to like managing the family wealth? What do you think goes wrong? Is it that the families don't kind of have this kind of framework of setting the mission, vision, and values for the entire family? Or is there something else that is like the underlying problem that isn't said here yet?
Sure. Yeah, a couple things. First, people often talk about how are we going to divide or split up the family wealth. We're interested in multiplying it, not dividing it. And so our kids are on board with that mission. Our mission is to be a family that maintains its identity as a force for good for generations. So we're not interested in dividing or splitting. We're interested in accumulating and multiplying and then giving it away as a family. But back to your main question there, Lily. I really think the issue is it comes around communication. Edwin Cole said that communication is the basis of life. And when there's rivalries or dissension or all those negative feelings that you mentioned before, I think at root there's a failure to communicate. And so we found that having the regular structured board meetings, is a tool to facilitate communication. Now, I've studied why don't people talk about money? And it's interesting how different sort of levels of socioeconomic status talk about or have re different reasons for not talking about money. So for working class or poor people, there's two main reasons. The first is shame. like I feel bad about the economic progress I've made or bad decisions I've made in the past, and so I don't want to talk about that. Or, and this surprised me, but in poor communities, if there's any extra money, there's an expectation that it will be shared. And so there is no ability to save and accumulate wealth because all the extra is to be dispersed. And so people in that category are afraid to talk about money if they have a little bit extra because they know they're going to get asked for it. And then for middle class and managerial class families, there's a couple main reasons. One is they don't want to spoil their kids. In other words, if the kids know that there's a certain level of wealth, mom and dad might be afraid that it will reduce their drive or their grit or something like this. And then secondly, there's some shame as well because they know that the reason they were able to accumulate so much wealth is because of their intense work ethic. And there's a sense of, gosh, maybe I didn't spend as much time with my children as I should have. And so there's a sense of shame there. And then for wealthy families, reasons they don't talk about wealth include that same issue of I don't want to spoil my kids or turn them into, nepo babies and whatnot. Shaquille O'Neal famously said, "We ain't rich, I'm rich." In other words, kids, this is not your wealth, this is dad's wealth. And then the other reason is there tends to be a heightened sense of privacy amongst wealthy families. So those are some of the barriers to talking about money. And the solution to the problems that you've identified, I think, is intentionally breaking through those barriers and opening the kimono, let your kids know what's going on, and then put it in the context, give it some structure, family board meetings, mission, vision, values. If we can talk about that stuff, then we can talk about decision making with some context and framework.
Thank you. What's your opinion on families that manage billions of dollars in assets that are unwilling to give any of that wealth to their children and instead prefer to give it to charity?
That to me is an abdication of responsibility. In other words, so the Ford family is a great example, great automobile manufacturers in my home state of Michigan. And there's the Ford Motor Company, which is still has family members on the board, but then there's the Ford Foundation. And in the 1960s, the Ford Foundation stopped being run by the family and they brought in independent directors. And it turns out the Ford Foundation has morphed into this organization that doesn't represent the family's values at all. That it's like they do things that are probably opposite of what the family's value system would be. And so if we choose to give our money away and all of our money away to unrelated people, they're just probably not very likely to share our values or carry forward our family's mission. They will tend to run into their on their own agenda at some point. And so I encourage families to empower their children, bring them into the conversation, and let the family manage the family's decision-making around money and charity.
Thank you. How can disjointed families that, let's say, have an absent father, an absent mother, or a narcissistic mother, a narcissistic father, or children that are not so interested in managing the wealth, or basically a family where everyone has their own interest, how can they turn from a disjointed family into a united family that pools all their money together so they can turn into a family that has billions in assets?
Well, I'm not sure if a narcissist is going to embark on a project like this. I think you have to have a fundamental psychological makeup that includes a sense of awareness and concern for others. And then I think narcissists are the opposite of that, right? But let's take somebody who's not a narcissist but is engrossed in his or her work or something like this. And as I said before, the communication is the key. And the way to approach big, scary conversations is to start with what my friend Roger Whitney calls little conversations. Let's develop the habits of communicating about non-emotional things on a regular basis so that we can then approach the bigger conversations. You know, if we don't talk about something, money, for example, for a long time, this tension builds. It's like a balloon that's being filled up with air and it's getting huge and very ready to explode. And nobody wants to touch the balloon because they don't want the explosion. But if we can have regular little conversations, now we're going to let the air out of the balloon a little bit at a time. And then it's not so scary and big. So I think this should start as young as possible. And now maybe if your children are grown, you're going to have to do this differently. But I think it's so important for families to share a common meal together without electronic devices on the table, to have conversations about how was your day? What do you need tonight? What does tomorrow look like? You're smiling, and this seems trite, maybe, but what it's doing, two things, is developing the habit of having interaction and conversation with each other. And kids are listening. How do mom and dad interact with each other? And how do they talk about their interactions with the world? You're essentially passing on values to your children at the dinner table. Much more is caught than is taught. And kids are catching how are mom and dad dealing with each other and making their way in the world. And so we think the most important question when you come home isn't what's for dinner, but what's dinner for? What is the purpose of dinner? And the purpose is, of course, we need some calories and nutrition, but more important than that is the formation of a communication pattern with our family, within our family, and the transmission of values. So that's for families that still have children at home. If you don't have children at home, you've got to force yourself into having a regular rhythm of communication, and it'll probably feel awkward. But if your kids are grown, schedule a Sunday afternoon Zoom call or a some sort of regular communication. Just talk about life, talk about what's going on, talk about the kids' schedule, talk about sports, whatever it is. But you've got to, if you can't talk about sports, you can't talk about money. You've got to establish the habit of having communication, regular communication with the people in your family.
Thank you. What would you say families need to do so they can change their habits and communication habits as well, so they can build a billion-dollar company? Because I find that you can be talking, but maybe the other person is not really listening, so nothing is registering in their head, what you actually said. And also, if let's say the father is a spender, the mother is a saver, or let's say they're both savers and then the children are spenders, whoever has the bad habits in the family can ruin the whole thing for the entire family. So, how can people manage these obstacles? Now, you did mention communication being like a big thing that people have to work on. But for example, in my case, I find it untenable to have a conversation with my own mother because every time I talk to her, she doesn't listen to anything I say. And if she does, she interrupts me every minute. It's impossible to actually tell her anything. The only way to actually get through to her is like to write her a message.
Well, maybe Lily, this project isn't going to happen between your mom's generation and you. I mean, that's possible, right? Not everybody's up for this. That's why most wealth gets dissipated, right? You started the conversation by saying, hey, lots of times this generational wealth doesn't actually impact the second or third generation. But maybe you can be G1, the first generation who does this with, I don't know your family situation, but with the next generation, your children or nieces and nephews or something like this. And so, if someone's not willing to play, then they're not willing. But if we've just got bad habits that we need to overcome, then you can do this. I think let's be clear. Hey, you know what, child, niece, nephew, I want to be intentional about changing my habits. Would you help me? Would you participate with me? And most people who love you are going to say, yes, I'll help you. Okay, great. So I want to get better at regular communication. Could I schedule a 20-minute call with you on Sundays at 3 p.m. to help me? So you're actually helping them too, but you're asking for help. So you put yourself in a little bit vulnerable position. And most people are going to say, of course, I want to help you, Lily. And then you just schedule it. And You could have an agenda, but I would not talk about money right away. Boy, I would talk about anything else. Talk about what shows do they like watch on streaming networks? What's important to them? But you've got to listen and be attentive. And you're a good listener. You're a podcast host. But so you've got that skill. Maybe you need to help them get that skill and develop a habit and a rhythm, a regular practice of communication. So like I said, not everybody's going to do it, but you've got to start with some regular communication about little conversations that aren't big and scary before you can get to the bigger and scarier conversations.
Thank you. What kind of spending or saving habits did you put in place for you and your family to empower your entire family to manage your wealth cumulatively better?
Yeah. So since the beginning of our marriage, my wife and I have had a weekly meeting. And so we just had it this morning, in fact. But people are like, you have a staff meeting with your wife? And it's like, well, she's not my staff. We're partners. So call it a partner meeting if you want to. But yeah, we have an agenda. We manage it in monday.com. It's a staff meeting agenda, right? Or a partner meeting agenda. We talk about the calendar. We review who needs to be where. Now our kids can all drive, but you know, when they were little, someone had to drop them off at practice and pick them up from the thing and go to dancing and all this. And so planning all of that out, planning our meals, so we know who's cooking what and when, therefore we know which groceries we need to buy. And we do a finance review. So each year we set a budget. Here's our spending plan. Some people don't like the word budget. Okay, let's call it a spending plan. It's how we're going to make money and spend money. And then we review that once a month. Now, when money was tight, we review it every week. Can we afford groceries this week? But now we're to the point where that's not a big issue. But how are we doing according to our spending plan? Now, I realize not everyone is quite that detailed or doesn't run their life quite like that. But frankly, we use the same skills at home that we use to manage a business. And we find that's not business skills, it's a life skill to be able to be planful and then to communicate on a regular basis and then to check in, how are we doing against our plan? And so I just encourage every family to have a regular schedule of meetings. For us, weekly seems to work great.
Thank you. Do you have any like specific spending or saving plan? Like, for example, would you say, oh, don't have more than, I don't know, 5 coffees a day, or I don't know, or only use this kind of vouchers for discounts, or I don't know, something that you put in place that was very specific, that was part of your family values and like way of operating, so that you can teach the children and your entire family how to manage the wealth better?
Yeah. So for our kids, we would give them allowance as soon as they could count. So small amounts, $10 or whatever the case was be. And then they would tithe. They would pay $1 of 10 into the church. That's one of our core principles, is that if we give a tenth back to God, he makes the other 90% more fruitful than it would have been otherwise. And so for our kids, we've done that. And we would let them say, we just give them the skills. Hey, I want this Lego set that costs $100. Okay, well, how long will it take you to save that much money? And then, you know, lay it out for them, essentially give them a savings plan for that. Now, in terms of my wife and I, we agree on our broad goals. Here's how much we're going to save. Here's what we're going to spend if we're going to buy a new vehicle or a new house or whatever like that. But then for those little things that cause friction, You bought 5 coffees today? That's crazy. Why would you do such a thing? Or for the thing, my wife likes to buy little things that decorate the house, you know, knickknacks. And I don't know what they are. They don't mean anything to me, but I don't want to be bugging my wife about knickknacks. And she doesn't want to be bugging me about how many bottles of wine did I buy, whatever. And so we each have what we call a fun account. And the fun account is unaccountable money. So we're accountable to how much is in there, but not what we spend it on. And so I have no idea what she spends her fun account money on. And I don't care, but it's $350 a month or whatever, I don't even know the number, but the number is fixed. And she doesn't have to report to me about that. And if I see a new knickknack in the house or a clock or whatever, she's like, eh, fun account. And I'm like, cool, you spend it on whatever you want. And so that is a way to reduce the friction. We agree on the amount, but we don't care what it's spent on.
Thank you. How can wealthy families raise non-bratty children that will be interested in managing the family wealth and will not end up doing their own thing and not be kind of like not even interested in doing anything because they're thinking, like daddy's already working, daddy's gonna buy me a car and actually I can buy like 100 cars if I want to because I can afford it.
Yeah. Well, daddy doesn't buy his kids too many cars. I've helped each kid get one car, and then I've given them an education and a value system and an orientation towards others to where we provide value and we receive value in return. And so that is a very, very basic. Jesus of Nazareth said, give and it shall be given to you. And the value creation cycle begins with giving. We give value to people and therefore we receive value back. So they've all got that value system. And so they know they need to work. And the family money is for the family's mission. It's not for sports cars and goofy things. In my opinion, goofy things. Now, if you like sports cars, that's cool. They can buy their own sports car
Thank you.
with their money they earn.
Tell us about the how does philanthropy impact your ability to build and to manage a billion-dollar business?
Yeah. So giving money away, in our opinion, is actually a key to building wealth. And so it seems strange, but it's true. There's a verse in the Proverbs that says, there is one who gathers more than he should, but he tends to lack. And there is one who scatters abroad, but tends to abound. In other words, there is just this reality that if we give money away, we're giving value, we're starting the value creation cycle, and money comes. And so our giving strategy is key to our wealth building strategy as well. And so we tithe on every dollar. I even calculate every quarter our unrealized gains on our investment portfolio, and I tithe on that, even though we haven't realized it. So if it went from 100 to, then I tithe on the 15. And then our family board has said, we want to give away so much percentage of our total net worth every year. And then that decision or that money, that whatever they decided, goes into our donor advised fund. And then the philanthropy committee makes decisions on how it should be distributed. And so I let the giving drive my investment decisions. And so I realized, gosh, these guys want to give a lot of money away. I need to switch from pure capital appreciation to income generation. And it's caused me to get into more real estate. I've added more cash flow in real estate into the investment portfolio because these guys, my family, is following our mission, vision, and values and giving a lot more money away than we had previously. So it is key to our wealth building strategy and our investment management approach.
Thank you. What are the top 10 ways for someone to build a billion-dollar wealth management companies a company? And what I mean is like the what should they be investing in? And is there like any particular assets they should be investing in? Or are there any things that entrepreneurs who want to do that need to know?
All right, you've asked me for 10. I don't know. You'll have to count, I guess. First thing I would say is invest in the people around you. So, another word for a family is a household. And a household is a house that holds things. Amongst the things they hold are assets and relationships. And I'll tell you, if you invest in the people around you, you'll attract more and more people, more and more resources, more and more skills and abilities and talents. And Lily, it really is a beautiful and amazing thing. So my wife and I recently started this company called Abundant Thought Revolution, and It's really just content creation designed to help people break through limiting beliefs and achieve their full potential and the abundant life that God has designed for each of us. And we're attracting people. We've hired a virtual admin, and then a graphics person came to us and said, "I want to work with you." Okay, great. And now someone's come to me and said, "Hey, I really want to do some coaching. Could you teach me how? And I'd love to do it under your company's." We're just attracting people. And so we're pouring into them, and not just their, not, but ideas and concepts and mentorship and things like that. So beautiful thing. So first thing is invest in people around you. Second, I'd say is invest in yourself. And by that, I mean, not just education and ideas, but time. I think many people are so busy, they don't actually have time to sort of refill their cup or be connected to their center or to their God or what have you. And so we take the first hour of the day as what we call the most important hour, and we read sacred scripture and we meditate on our day and we ask for God's guidance. And so that would be my second thing, is to invest in yourself, invest in the people around you, invest in yourself. Now, in terms of specifics, I like to buy real estate in low-priced markets to buy and hold. Now, you're not getting a lot of capital appreciation, but you get the cash flow. I like to buy real estate, buy and add value to real estate in high-priced markets. I mentioned my son is a general contractor. He's on the West Coast of the United States, high-priced real estate market. Together, we buy properties, add an ADU, renovate the house, what have you, and then we sell those and add a bunch of value. So those are two more ideas. I think my default investment strategy for stocks is to buy the U.S. stock market, and I like to buy all the stocks in the S&P 500. So my brokerage statement is really long because there's 500 positions in it, but the reason we do that rather than buying an index fund is when any position is at a 4% tax loss. So you bought it for 100, if it's 96, we sell that position, take the proceeds, and buy an index fund for 31 days. And then we sell the index fund and go back and buy that individual position again. And so that does a few things for us. One, we're often actually getting buying positions at a lower price. And so we've got a more value, if you will. But then we're also capturing tax alpha. So in addition to the return on the market return, we're getting a tax benefit, or a tax alpha, I call it. So that's, don't bet against the US unless there's a compelling reason to do so. I'll just say this: I don't understand crypto. I've owned a portfolio of crypto and watched it very carefully and tried to understand what causes it to go up and down. It doesn't seem to be, price action in crypto doesn't seem to be correlated to interest rates or GDP prints or stock market prices or anything else. And so to me, if it's uninvestable, excuse me, if it's not understandable, it's not investable. So I think I've given you six or seven. So you've worn me out.
Thank you. What are the biggest mistakes that entrepreneurs make when it comes to building a company that is very successful?
I think the one of the biggest mistakes I see is thinking that we know best. And so it we have the initial idea usually for a business, and we have lots of skills, but holding on to all the decisions is a recipe to make ourselves very, very busy and burnt out, and we're limiting the business to our abilities. It can only move as fast as we can move. And so, as soon as possible, I encourage every entrepreneur, every leader, to bring people on their team and outsource decision making and outsource responsibility and divest yourself of power. Put it out there for other people to add their own ideas and value. And it's scary for entrepreneurs, and it's hard to figure out what to delegate, but it's a critical tool. I'll tell a quick story. In 2014, we were at 125 million and set a goal to get to a billion. And 1 year later, we really hadn't made much progress. And so I did a time study on myself. We'd identified mergers and acquisitions as our biggest opportunity. And And I wanted to know, where is my time going as the primary leader? So this was before AI. And so in 15-minute increments on an Excel worksheet, I'm tracking what did I do at work for 2 weeks. So at the end of this, I hit over 400 data points. And then I consolidated them into four bigger categories. I think it was client service, investment management, running the business, and then M&A got the, of course, predictably, the least amount of focus. It was our biggest opportunity, least amount of my time. And so we took that information and said, okay, I'm making two key hires. I'm going to hire someone to take some of my client service load, and I'm going to hire someone to be purely dedicated to admin on mergers and acquisitions. We didn't even teach her how to serve clients because we knew she'd get sucked into operations if she knew how. We didn't give her a password or software for that, and she couldn't help with that. So now I had to keep her busy full time working on the most important things. So I would say for entrepreneurs, to sum this up, oh, and let's just wrap it up. 5 years later, we were at $1.25 billion. So we 10x'd in 5 years. I think largely because I was able to divest myself of responsibility, hire good people to do those things. So I encourage radical outsourcing. If someone else can do it, they should do it and empower the leader to do the things that only she or he can do.
Thank you. What are some habits and routines that can enable someone who has a very successful business to be able to build a billion-dollar company and to exit?
Well, I mentioned this before, but I think having a personal discipline or routine of a daily quiet time where we are proactive about setting our agenda, about hearing from our maker, and not being reactive and responding to everything. I think that's a critical thing to start your day, to give you a sense of clarity before you jump into your work.
Thank you.
Radical outsourcing. And then I would say, always be looking for the next person. Even if you don't have an opening on your team, have your com always have your radar open. Who's on your bench? Who's the next person that could fill every position that you're responsible for filling? So I would develop relationships with people for years before I knew I had a position for them. But somebody, they're a great salesperson at us when you're buying a suit or a sweater or something like that. Ah, that person might be on my sales team. So always be building your bench.
Thank you. What awakened the Titan within for you and your wife and your entire family? Like, was there any specific moment where you felt empowered to perhaps go from feeling relatively small to feeling like, you are this Titan that can like do, make great things happen?
Yeah, there's a guy, I think he's still alive. His name is Bob Harrison, and he's a Christian preacher, and his nickname was Dr. Increase. And so when he would go to preach somewhere, he had this little card, like a table tent kind of thing that he would set on top of the podium, and it just said Dr. Increase. And he had business cards that he had printed up, and they quoted one of the Psalms, Psalm 115, verse 14. The Lord shall increase me more and more, me and my children. And I just grabbed onto his message, and I bought back, this is a long time ago, I bought his CDs, and I would listen to them in the car and listen to his teaching about that, that we're created to be prosperous and to pour into other people, and you can't give if you don't receive, and all this kind of stuff. And that was more than 20 years ago, and I just really caught that message, and my wife was on board as well. And so we realized, hey, we can do more than get by.
Thank you. What kind of message or affirmations can parents and children use to empower themselves to build a billion-dollar company?
Yeah, Lily, I have a series of daily affirmations that I get from Hebrew and Christian scriptures. Other people may have a different faith tradition, but for me, Isaiah 48, 27, I am the Lord who teaches you to profit. Deuteronomy 8, 18, you shall remember the Lord your God who gives you the power to get wealth that he may confirm his covenant that he swore to your fathers, even as it is this day, etc. And so I have these scriptural affirmations and then say, I have more value to give now than I ever have before. My days of creating great wealth have not stopped. And so I start with ancient scripture and then apply it to me and my life. And that's part of what I do each morning.
Thank you. Is there anything that your family puts in place to stay on this like really high vibration? Because I find that, let's say you can wake up empowered, you read the scripture, you meditate, you feel really great. And then something really terrible can happen during the day that can take you off your pedestal where you feel a little bit like disempowered or scared, or, you know, like something really terrible can happen on the news that you hear of. And you get this kind of like anxiety or panic, or let's say something happens in your business that is not working as well as you'd like to. And temporarily, you can again feel a little bit of anxiety. So how can you stay on this like high vibration all of the time so you continuously feel empowered despite all the different negative things that may happen in your life or your business or the in your neighborhood?
Yeah. Well, I thank you for asking about that. So you may know I've written a book called Thinking for Success. And one of the chapters talks about our area of influence versus our area of concern. And so we have an area of influence. The only thing we control is ourselves. And then we have influence over a relatively small sphere, you know, if you think about it compared to the whole world. And the world is big. Right now there's war in Iran and it's spreading throughout the Middle East. And so I can worry about that, but I have zero influence over US or Israeli foreign policy or Iranian foreign policy. None. I mean, I could call a senator and leave a message or something like that. But so if I put my concern out there at those things that are very far away from me, that are a big gap between my concern and my influence, that big gap represents anxiety. But if I can keep my area of concern quite close to my area of influence, now I've reduced the scope or even the room for anxiety to come in. So we can either expand our area of influence or we can reduce our area of concern. And so I find that it's most powerful, we're most effective when what we're worried or concerned or focused on is very close to our area of influence. I can't control foreign policy. I can control how do I treat my wife? What decisions do I make in terms of business? What are my inputs to my children? Am I treating the people around me with grace and as people who bear the image of God? Those are the things I can control and have influence over. And so if that's what I'm focused on, there's no room for anxiety because I can control those.
Thank you. How can entrepreneurs connect with you?
Yeah, well, thank you so much. My book I just mentioned is a great way to get more of my thinking for success. It's available everywhere books are sold. AbundantThoughtRevolution.com. My wife and I post insights several times a week, and then we're on all the socials at Abundant Thought Revolution. So that's a great way to hear what we're up to and get into our thinking. And people are connecting with me on LinkedIn frequently, and that's really fun. Someone will send me a note. I heard you on Lily's podcast, did you ever think about this? It's really wonderful. It's so enjoyable.
Thank you.
Follow us for more interviews with world's most influential business titans, providing you with the insights to awaken to your full potential so you can get paid to be yourself, find true happiness, and manifest anything you desire.